Hello, it is Tuesday, the 16th of June. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. The Conservative People Power Party said it would seek a redo of elections in six regions of the country affected by ballot shortages on June 3rd. More on that on today's news briefing. Later, during our in-depth news analysis segment, we will be joined by two experts to discuss the potential end of the Iran war and whether the peace deal will hold. Plus, on this week's Hollywood Highlights, Bernie Cho joins us again in the studio to talk about some big names in the World Cup and a virtual K-pop boy band. Korea 24 starts now. Political parties are clashing over the People Power Party's decision to seek re-elections in six regions of the country due to ballot shortages on June 3rd. The Democratic Party says the move is an attempt to manipulate the election outcome, while the PPP says it is trying to preserve voting rights. For more on the aftermath of the ballot shortages and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us again Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-kyung, with us. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Andrew.
The PPP held an emergency Supreme Council meeting on Monday to discuss the ballot shortages and decided to file objections with the National Election Commission seeking re-elections in six regions. In-kyung, tell us more.
Sure. The party said it would file formal objections in six regions where ballot shortages were reported. The PPP is disputing the election results for Seoul, Gyeonggi Province, Incheon, Busan, Ulsan, and the combined electoral district of Gwangju and South Jeolla Province. The re-election would cover heads of metropolitan and municipal governments as well as council members. But the party isn't united over the decision to redo the elections. The PPP is holding a general meeting of lawmakers tomorrow after a junior group of lawmakers called for one, saying the party leadership shouldn't make decisions like this on their own. The PPP Seoul Mayor Oh Se-hoon, who was re-elected to a fifth term, also said the decision seems to be politically motivated. He said PPP Chief Jang Dong-hyuk is only focused on a revote when the investigation and reforming the electoral system should take priority.
What is the opposing ruling Democratic Party saying?
Floor Leader Han Byung-do called the move totally contradictory. He said it hurts the very voting rights the PPP claims it wants to protect. Deputy Floor Leader Chun Jun-ho was more scathing. He said the PPP doesn't plan to file similar objections for Daegu or South Gyeongsang Province, where ballot shortages had also been reported. He said the selective nature of the objections made no sense and looked like an attempt to manipulate the election outcome.
But the rival parties did come to an important agreement over the ballot shortages. In-kyung, can you explain?
Sure. The two parties agreed to launch a parliamentary investigation into the issue. The inquiry will run for 45 days and may be extended if additional investigation is required. Deputy floor leaders of the two parties met on Tuesday and agreed to put the plan to a vote at a plenary session on Thursday. The National Assembly will form a special committee for the probe comprising 18 members, 9 from the ruling party, 7 from the PPP, and 2 from non-negotiating parties. And the People Power Party will hold the chairmanship. The investigation will cover the National Election Commission as well as regional election commissions. Witnesses will include the Interior Minister, ministry officials, and local government officials from the affected areas.
There is, of course, a different angle to this story. While the political parties are hashing out their differences, protesters are blocking a handball gymnasium at Olympic Park in southern Seoul that had served as a vote counting center for the 12th day, the protest, that is, and sports organizations housed inside the gymnasium are still unable to enter the facility. What's the latest?
The chief of the Korean Sport and Olympic Committee, Yoo Seung-min, held a press conference on Wednesday urging measures to open the sports offices. 9 sports organizations are housed inside the gymnasium, including fencing, water skiing, and sports dance, and officials haven't been able to go inside for days. Some sports organizations have had problems preparing for the Aichi Nagoya Asian Games in September. Protesters, sports organizations, and police reached an agreement to allow access to the facility by sports groups to retrieve things they needed for their work. But when the officials tried to enter, a protester resisted them by standing in front of the doors and holding on to both door handles. PPP lawmakers and some protesters tried to persuade her to let go but gave up after she refused. Given that the protest does not have an organizer, there is no one who can control the actions of individual participants. Meanwhile, Minister of the Interior and Safety Yoon Ho-jung said a number of illegal incidents that undermine law and order have occurred during the protests. He said the government will track down all those responsible and hold them to account.
Let's move on now to news on the Middle East conflict. The U.S. and Iran are trumpeting their tentative ceasefire deal as a victory, but maritime operators remain hesitant due to conflicting directives from the two sides. What's the story?
Let's take a listen first to President Trump, who is now in Avignon, France, attending the Group of Seven summit.
The deal's all signed, and the strait is already partially opened. As you know, they're doing a little hunting for a couple of mines that they've already found. But it's essentially ships are starting to go out now. On Friday, it'll be completely opened. And it's toll-free. We had a little argument on that. It's toll-free. So I don't think we're going to need much help. But I don't think it's a bad idea to have a ship or two up here.
So he's touting the agreement with Iran and saying the Strait of Hormuz will fully reopen on Friday. But Iran says the waterway will gradually open within 30 days under Iranian control. And as you heard, Trump also says the Strait will be toll-free, but Iran says it might charge service fees. Services, it says, are needed for navigation, environmental protection and insurance. Take a listen to Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghaei.
We've always said we're not after charging tolls, but in exchange for services we will provide, including navigation, environmental protection services, and maybe even insurance services and other services offered by Iran and Oman, necessary costs will be outlined and received.
The conflicting interpretations over transit costs might bring another round of clashes during the 60-day negotiations to hammer out a permanent peace deal between Washington and Tehran. Hundreds of ships and thousands of seafarers are still stranded in the Persian Gulf and surrounding waters due to the closure of the strait. This includes 137 South Korean crew members aboard 24 vessels.
And that's all for today's news briefing. Thank you, Inyo.
Thanks, Andrew.
Hello everybody, my name is B-Boy Phil Wizard and I am the Breaking Gold Medalist from the Paris 2024 Olympic Games, and you are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The United States and Iran have reached a peace deal that is set to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and lift the American naval blockade on Iranian ports. An official signing ceremony is expected Friday in Switzerland, followed by a 60-day period for both countries to negotiate details, including the future of Iran's nuclear program. But the two countries seem to be at odds over the necessary conditions for the reopening of the strait, causing confusion for the thousands of seafarers still stranded there. So despite the deal, many questions remain, such as the prospects of nuclear talks and whether the deal will hold at all. To discuss the U.S.-Iran agreement, what's at stake, and its likely economic impact on South Korea and the world, we are joined on the line by two guests. First, we have Philip Vaughn, crude expert and senior managing analyst at S&P Global Energy in Singapore. Hello, Mr. Vaughn.
Hello, and good evening.
We also have Dr. Siavashi Safari, a political scientist at Seoul National University who specializes in modern Middle Eastern history and politics. Hello, Dr. Safari.
Hello, good evening. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
Dr. Safari, before we talk about the implications of this latest U.S.-Iran deal, please explain for our listeners the agreement the U.S. and Iran are set to sign and what it includes and doesn't include.
Well, we still don't know the exact terms, but yesterday, some Iranian media outlets published 14 points, which are supposedly included in this MOU, this Memorandum of Understanding. There are a few key points here that I'll mention. One of them, of course, is that there will be an immediate end of conflict on all fronts, including in Lebanon. Both the U.S. and Iran will end their blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. makes a commitment to respect Iran's sovereignty, meaning that the U.S. will not attack Iran. U.S. and Iran will enter into 60 days of negotiations to reach a final agreement on all the major sticking points. And these are, of course, Iran's nuclear program, U.S. sanctions against Iran. And based on these 14 points, it seems that $12 billion of Iran's frozen assets will be released at the start of the negotiations, and another $12 billion will be released following the final agreement. And during the 60-day negotiation, the U.S. has committed not to bring more troops to the Middle East or add more sanctions to Iran. And in this period, Iran can sell its oil and petrochemical products. Now, the 60-day negotiations will only focus on the nuclear issues and sanctions. They will not include any discussion about Iran's missile program or Iran's relations with its regional allies. And on the nuclear issue, Iran will reiterate its commitments under the NPT, that's the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. All the other details are going to be worked out later. And one last point is that there is a stipulation by which countries in the region are going to commit to spend $300 billion for the reconstruction of Iran. So this is what Iran has been sharing. They generally seem to be consistent with the details that came out of the April negotiations in Pakistan. The U.S. side hasn't released its version of the agreement, but U.S. officials have basically confirmed at least some of these 14 points. So we heard Vice President J.D. Vance mention this figure of $300 billion that will be spent on Iran's reconstruction. I suspect that in the next few days we'll hear more details.
So I guess everyone's now wondering which side has won the war, if we can say that. Dr. Safwari, do you think this is what the Trump administration wanted, or is this something closer to a face-saving measure that the administration accepted in order to lift the stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, you know, if we look at it from the perspective of ordinary people, I think wars have no winners. They only have losers. But if we look at the geopolitics, I think it's clear that for the U.S. side, this war was an epic failure, right? We remember the stated goals of the war that the U.S. government and Donald Trump announced at the beginning of this war. There was talk of forcing Iran to capitulate on a whole series of issues. The U.S. talked about enforcing zero-level uranium enrichment, dismantling Iran's entire nuclear program, limiting Iran's missile program, ending Iran's relationships with its regional allies, its support for its regional allies. And also at some point we heard talk of regime change in Iran. None of these have been achieved. And so in that sense, we can say the U.S. began a senseless war, really, that ended up losing. This is not to say that Iran comes out of this war with a complete and total victory. I mean, it's true that Iran was quite successful in its military strategy, fighting two nuclear powers, the world superpower. And it's also true that Iran was somewhat successful in resisting. But at the same time, we have to remember Iran took some big hits. It lost its leaders, many military commanders, and also U.S. and Israel destroyed much of Iran's civilian infrastructure, factories, bridges, and so on and so forth. So it's going to take Iran years to recover from this war. But of course, if the final negotiations are successful and if sanctions are lifted, that could be a game changer for Iran.
Mr. Vaughn, you're a crude oil expert. Crude oil experts and market analysts view this U.S.-Iran MOU as a major bearish catalyst. How does the news of the U.S.-Iran deal affect global oil prices?
Well, bearish catalyst it certainly is. I mean, because the immediate market reaction has been the removal of a large part of the geopolitical risk premium, right? So on the derivative side, front month ICE Brent futures tumbled from the average range of roughly $95 to $100, $105 per barrel range in April or May to a fresh low, three-month low of around $82 this morning. For physical market indicators, our own S&P Global's Middle Eastern benchmark, Cash Dubai, was assessed below $80 per barrel at $78.90 on Monday. And shortly, we will be releasing today's benchmark price assessment. So any financial or energy market professional listening right now that can check today's physical market benchmark in about 1 or 2 hours. Anyway, based on the Monday's Cash Dubai benchmark price of $78.90 per barrel, this would be 53% roughly decline from the record high of around $170 per barrel on March 23rd. Now, industry and trading professionals are closely watching the forward curve structure of S&P Global Dubai benchmark as well, which is Cash Dubai to second month Dubai swap spread. This is also known as the Dubai market structure. This basically narrowed to about $2.28 on Monday from a peak of nearly $70 in March. So in simple terms, I'll make it easy for you guys. The sharply narrow backwardation in the Dubai market structure, this would lead to a much, much lower monthly official selling prices from various Middle Eastern producers going forward.
Other than oil prices and the question of who has won, the other question is whether or not the two sides are actually going to sign the documents on Friday. Dr. Safwadi, there have been conflicting interpretations over transit costs, this being one of the many, concerns swirling around in the rumor mill, with Trump saying that the ships will be able to pass toll-free, whereas Iran has said that ships may have to pay some type of payment, although that payment has not been described as tolls. This divergence of views could undermine the coming talks during the 60-day peace period. But are there any risk factors that could overturn the situation much ahead, before the ceremony Friday?
Well, I mean, that's a big and tough question to answer. We know that things are moving at a very fast pace, and we know that things have been changing quite a lot. But based on what we hear, it seems that American and Iranian leaders have already added their electronic signatures to this agreement. On the U.S. side, we've heard that both President Trump and J.D. Vance have signed, or at least electronically. On the Iranian side, we've heard that the chief negotiator and the Speaker of the House, Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf, and also Iran's foreign minister, Ambassador Abbas Araghchi, have signed this. So there's a good chance that we will see some kind of signing ceremony on Friday. But as you mentioned quite correctly, there are several risk factors. Even if we see a signing ceremony on Friday, there are many issues to be worked out. I mentioned that during the 60-day period, there are several factors that need to be discussed, including those major sticking points about Iran's nuclear program and sanctions. And there are also other risk factors that could derail the entire negotiation process. And one of the major risk factors, of course, comes from Israel, which has long been an agent of destabilization, at least for the last few years in the Middle East. We know that the agreement includes ending the war in Lebanon. The Iranian side has confirmed that. The Pakistani negotiators have confirmed this. But Israel has made it very clear that it will not abide by this agreement. We have heard this not only from Netanyahu's government and his cabinet ministers, but also from opposition parties in Israel. So that's going to be something that we should keep an eye on. And I think it's really important that countries around the world, including South Korea and other countries in East Asia, apply all the pressure that they can to make sure that a risk factor like Israel doesn't derail this whole process and sabotage this agreement.
The possibility of Israel resuming violence in its border area with Lebanon, a sticking factor. Mr. Vaughn, the agreement is designed to restore the critical crude oil shipping lane that once was the Strait of Hormuz. This waterway handled about 20% of global oil and liquefied natural gas shipments. Countries like South Korea and Japan were and are reliant on energy imports through the Hormuz. Here in Seoul, the government has sought to put a lid on oil prices by imposing a price cap and reducing demand in part by requiring employees of the government and public corporations to commute by public transportation about half the time. The U.S.-Iran deal is aggressively unwinding the war's geopolitical risk premium, but crude oil and energy experts like yourself have warned that fully restoring global oil flows will face significant logistical delays. When the Hormuz is reopened, what does that mean for crude supply for Asian countries like South Korea and Japan? How long do you think it will take for the supply to return to pre-war levels?
That's a very good question. And let me first of all point out and separate the financial market reaction from the physical supply chain reality. Well, financial markets, first of all, can react almost immediately once the financial market believes the risk of a prolonged supply disruption is lower. Brent, Dubai, and other crude benchmarks, they can quickly remove part of the geopolitical risk premium. But physical crude flows take much longer to normalize. Even if the strait is reopened, there is a logistical lag. For example, tankers, the vessels need to be scheduled, repositioned. The ship owners and insurers need to reassess their war risk premiums. Oil terminals need to confirm loading and berthing. And the buyers, the refiners, need to adjust their crude nominations and delivery schedules and programs. So, basically the market can replace risk in hours, but actual cargo flows usually normalize over weeks or months. For Asian buyers, your second question, if I remember, the first impact will be improved confidence in Middle Eastern term crude supply. Term liftings and loadings from major producers could gradually come back on track, and the spot market offers for Middle Eastern crude grades like Basra Medium, Qatar Marine, Al-Shaheen crude, Upper Zakum crude, they all could become more visible again. For timing-wise, just to wrap this up, I would expect partial normalization within several weeks, perhaps. But in full return to pre-war logistic level, this could realistically take a few months at least.
So we're looking at a timeline of at least a few months for everything to normalize. And this is, of course, based on the presumption that things on the political side go smoothly. Korean oil refineries are actively seeking to diversify their sources for oil to reduce reliance on the Middle East, in part because the current war has shown why it could be better to have a more diverse network of sellers. Mr. Vaughn, do you think the supply dynamics of oil will change going forward for South Korea and other Asian countries?
Oh, yes, I do think definitely supply dynamics will gradually change. Not because Asian refiners will move away from Middle Eastern crude entirely, but because the crisis has reinforced the need for diversification, right? Even if the U.S.-Iran MOU leads to peace deal, South Korea, Japan, India, China, Thailand, Taiwan, Vietnam, all these Asian crude importers, they're unlikely to simply return to the old procurement patterns. The geopolitical situation can change very quickly, and this episode has shown again that relying too heavily on one region, this carries real energy security risks. Definitely worth noting that South Korea has shown notable resilience during this period. The Lee Jae-myung administration and the private sector refiners, SK, GS, Hyundai Oil Bank, S-Oil, they've all weathered the Middle Eastern crude supply disruption, I'd say better than all other Asian countries by moving quickly to diversify. Now, Japan has definitely learned a valuable lesson, I must say, Japan, because the country relies more than 95% of its crude needs traditionally from the Middle Eastern suppliers. So the disruption has been strong reminder that supply diversification matters just as much as price competitiveness. So, the Middle East will remain a core supplier. Don't get me wrong. Middle East will remain a core supply for Asia because of its grand scale. the specification of each crude grades. They tend to fit Asian refinery system very well, and due to the established long-term contracts as well. But one thing for sure is that going forward, I expect Asian refineries to keep a more diversified crude slate, build more flexibility around crude procurement strategy.
One lesson that has been drawn by many countries is don't put all your eggs in one basket. But the deal, the tentative deal, leaves key nuclear issues to be negotiated over the next 2 months. Dr. Safadi, what's your assessment? Do you think the two sides will be able to reach a nuclear deal?
Well, that's the $1 million question, isn't it? It would depend on several factors, and mainly it would really depend on what the U.S. would want to get from such an agreement. If the U.S.'s goal is to put Iran's nuclear program under some kind of international monitoring regime, and to make sure that Iran doesn't acquire a nuclear bomb at some point down the line, I think a nuclear agreement would be quite possible. Remember that Iran already accepted these terms under the 2015 nuclear agreement with Obama. That was the JCPOA. And we also know that Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. From what I understand, in the last few months in these negotiations, the Iranian side has expressed that it's willing to suspend nuclear or rather uranium enrichment levels or their uranium enrichment program for up to 10 years. And then after these 10 years, they would keep it at 3.6%, which is the minimum level needed for their domestic use. But if the U.S. insists that Iran should dismantle its nuclear program, what is usually called the Libyan option, or if the U.S. insists that Iran should have 0% uranium enrichment level, I think that's a non-starter. Iran would never agree to these terms. They didn't agree to these terms while they were being bombed by the U.S. Why would they agree now?
Those are very nice points, saying U.S. maximalist demands will lead the negotiations nowhere. But speaking of nuclear negotiations, President Trump posted a photo taken with North Korea's Kim Jong-un on social media on Sunday while announcing developments with Iran. Trump uploaded the photo showing himself taking a walk with Kim Jong-un during the first North Korea-U.S. summit held in Singapore on June 12, 2018. This was, of course, during President Trump's first term. What did that photo mean in terms of that photo being uploaded, Dr. Safadi? If you could take an educated guess, and what are the implications of the Iran war for the Korean Peninsula? What lessons have North Korean leader Kim Jong-un drawn from the war? And how is Kim Jong-un digesting the outcome of the conflict in the Middle East, especially in light of the way the U.S. conducted the war, trying to rely on air power to subdue its enemy without inserting ground troops? Dr. Safadi, your thoughts?
Well, as you know, I'm not an expert in the area of North Korea, and I don't dare to speak specifically on that issue. But what I can say is that, you know, what the U.S. and Israel did over the last 12 months, because it's really been 12 months of a war on Iran, where in June, we're on the first year anniversary of the first U.S.-Israeli bombardment of Iran last June. So what the U.S. and Israel have done over the last 12 months is that they have really undermined non-proliferation efforts everywhere in the world, including here in the Korean Peninsula. In the last 12 months, U.S. and Israel, which are both nuclear powers, they have launched two wars of aggression against Iran, which is not a nuclear power, and is actually a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I think that the whole world looks at this, probably in North Korea as well, and they walk away with this message, which is, if you don't have nuclear weapons, you will be vulnerable to attacks from nuclear powers. This sets the whole world on an extremely dangerous course. Nuclear countries like North Korea will probably want to keep their nuclear weapons. They will look at the example of Iran. They will look at the example of Libya when Libya gave up its nuclear program. They will look at the example of Ukraine and other countries as well. And non-nuclear countries would want to acquire nuclear weapons. I think we should all be very concerned about such a scenario, not only on the Korean Peninsula, but around the world. And we should insist that, you know, the world needs nuclear disarmament now more than ever before. And disarmament cannot be selective. You can't say that North Korea should disarm, but Israel can keep its nuclear arsenal. This is the kind of double standard and hypocrisy that only sets us up for failure.
Those were the points that some other experts on the show have raised. The question of whether or not you have nuclear weapons will lead or will determine whether or not you get attacked by other nuclear powers. So obviously incentivizing certain countries to keep or maybe even develop nuclear weapons. But that's all we have for today's in-depth news analysis. We were joined on the line by Philip Vaughn from S&P Global Energy in Singapore. Thank you, Mr. Vaughn.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
We also had Dr. Siavashi Safari from Seoul National University. Thank you, Dr. Safari.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 180.62 points, or 2.11% on Tuesday, to close at 8,726.6. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 15.35 points, or 1.48%, to close at 1,018.68. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets, handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
So, what's our first story?
A new survey shows clear changes in drinking habits in Seoul residents, the standout figure being nearly one out of four respondents not consuming alcoholic beverages at all.
I think this country needed that. There was a time when drinking was just the thing that almost everyone here did. It was kind of expected. But times are changing, clearly. What do the numbers say?
The Seoul Metropolitan Government unveiled the results of a survey conducted on more than 3,000 adults on Sunday. It showed nearly 24% did not consume alcoholic beverages in the past 12 months. So that's more than 21% spike compared to the previous year's survey. And so the new citywide survey clearly shows drinking frequency is decreasing overall.
So what about those who don't, or actually who do drink? Any noteworthy changes on that front?
So even among that group, those drinking several times a week appears to be declining, with those drinking four or more times a week marking a decline too, down to only 1%. The figures all went down for those drinking in less frequency than this group.
Again, as I said earlier, drinking less is, I think, what this country needed. Four times a week sounds a little too many. But what are some of the potential factors driving this drier trend?
Well, some experts pointed to major factors, people tightening their belts and their wallets in response to inflation, as drinking outings usually lead to quite expensive bills. A growing attention to health and wellness, that's another driving force. More and more people opt to hit the gym, exercise, do sports, eat well, and avoid unhealthy habits.
Now that you say it, I should try to go to the gym more often and eat healthier. But if people are doing less drinking, what are they eating or drinking instead?
Well, there's a lot more growing trend towards vegetarianism. People are turning more vegan or vegetarian. There's a growing number that supports it. People are even conscious about the kind of food they consume, which will be a more healthier option than meats and, I suppose, fast foods or oily alternatives.
Let's move on to our next story.
The man behind the Taegu Warriors' psyche says that this year's World Cup squad is special and that they seem to set to be achieving something incredible.
I didn't know the national team had a psychiatrist. But when you think of it, it makes sense because the World Cup is watched by millions of people, not only here, but around the world. One mistake on the pitch could stain your reputation. You know, it could hang over you with your entire life, while one goal could elevate you instantly to national hero status. So the stakes are obviously huge from an individual player's perspective. But so who is this staff member on the national team?
His name is Han Deok-hyun. He is the Korean team's psychologist for the FIFA World Cup 2026 campaign. He's a professor in the Department of Neuropsychiatry at Chungang University Hospital and has worked with athletes in various sports for more than 25 years, including baseball and football. From 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. daily, Han holds countless meetings with players and the coaches on a daily basis. There, over in the team's training site in Zapopan, Mexico, on Monday local time, he said this World Cup group is a very special one and that he was especially blown away by the level of preparations before the games because of the thorough prep. Even defender Lee Ki-hyuk, a surprise pick making his maiden World Cup appearance, wasn't nervous at all and even played a key role in the win.
Which aspect in particular did Han give high praise to when it comes to how the team got ready?
Well, on the 2-1 victory over Czech Republic, a come-from-behind victory there, going into the match, he felt confident the team will win as they were preparing for every possible scenario. The players were armed and ready in every aspect, technically and mentally, and they were in a very stable state, so they would not falter even if they give up an early lead. And even after the big win, Han said he was very impressed by how the players didn't let it get to their head. They were ensuring they do not get too high, rather they were staying focused on what's next, the task at hand, which is why he feels that they're in a great spot mentally ahead of the second Group A match against Mexico this week. Han's advice for the players going to the match is, usually you would hear things like, you know, give it your all. But he instead said, just do what you train to do.
I guess his job is to keep people calm and ready mentally. So best of luck to Team Korea this week as well. So what's our final story, though?
Well, we have the UN-designated World Refugee Day coming up on June 20th. To mark the occasion, various events are being planned here in Korea, the standout being the Korea Refugee Film Festival.
Only natural that Korea, which boasts a globally recognized cinema industry, which unfortunately is not doing very well these days, but holding a film festival to mark World Refugee Day. Dan, so details, please.
So the 10th edition of the Korea Refugee Film Festival is back, and it was founded in 2015 to bring refugee stories to the Korean public through cinema and also to help screen films that explore displacement, asylum, identity, and resilience from diverse perspectives. This year, it is also part of the 75th anniversary of the 1951 Refugee Convention. The Film Fest is set to be held on Wednesday in Art House Momo, located in Ewha Women's University in Seoul.
So Wednesday at Ewha Women's University in Seoul. But since we don't have time to go through every film that's being featured there, can you give us a few standouts?
We have two film premieres, Allies in Exile by Syrian refugee filmmaker Hassan Katan, and A Lighter Between Invisible Bars by Liam Han, a refugee from Myanmar living in Korea. The program is rounded out by two European productions, Green Border by Agnieszka Holland and Cannes Prize-winning Soleiman's Story by Boris Lotkin.
World Refugee Day is, I guess, lesser known than it should be. So other than this film festival, what kind of other events are lined up?
Well, there are various cultural events lined up, including busking concerts on the 20th in Tuksam Hangang Park, featuring refugees from 10 different countries, providing music and dance performances. A Nansan Refugee Rights Center hosted various meetings in Nagwon Arcade in Jongno-gu, Seoul last week, bringing together activists and experts from various fields to discuss policies and laws related to refugees in the nation. Various fundraising events are also being held involving sales of various merchandise, including key rings, pouch, and other products that feature UNHCR official characters Undok and Toto.
And that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us all the stories, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, my name is Jocelyn Clark. I'm the first official non-Korean licensee of Gayagum Sanjo in Korea. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Welcome to this week's edition of Hallyu Highlights, your weekly scoop on everything hot in Korean entertainment, from the latest K-pop hits to the K-dramas everyone's binging. And as usual, we are joined in the studio today by our resident K-culture expert, Bernie Cho. Bernie, great to see you again, and welcome back from Finland.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Oh my goodness, the word resident makes me sound like I feel like I live here, but it kind of sort of feels like it, but all good. Let's run. Let's go.
Hard to believe. It's just been almost a week since the World Cup kicked off in North America with so much excitement, so much suspense, and even a few surprises. In addition to an array of amazing games, including an impressive 2-1 win by the Taeguk Warriors over Czechia, there has also been a lot of great music, particularly K-pop music, being featured in the competition. We talked about some of that last week, and we were aware of Lisa's participation in advance. But there was at least one more star who was out and about, EJ of K-pop Demon Hunter fame. And I hear there will be at least one more huge name waiting for us as well. Bernie, what's going on?
Yeah, look, for full disclosure, I watched the opening game, Daehanminguk, at 5 in the morning in Finland, and that was the best early wake-up I could have ever had. For those of you who've never been to Scandinavia, guess what? The sun does not set, so it's really hard to sleep. And the sun was still up, so I felt like it was daytime. But nonetheless, incredibly exciting. But what I did not expect earlier in the World Cup tourney is, look, we all knew Lisa was, as the kids like to say, going to be fire on that main stage in Los Angeles at SoFi Stadium. We knew it was coming. We saw it come. She absolutely killed it, crushed it, lived up to being the La Lisa. And, you know, she was on stage with some of the biggest superstars. But truthfully, arguably, not really much of an argument. The bigger stage was actually in Mexico City. And I mean, this is like a triple A all-star team of anybody and everybody from around the world. Representing North America and hip-hop was Megan Thee Stallion. Representing Europe was the DJ super producer David Guetta. An always safe go-to. One of the three tenors, and in this case by himself, was Andrea Bocelli. But what we didn't expect, was not announced, was EJ. And I got to say, she not only had the look, but my goodness, she had the voice that really just took people's breaths away. And to her credit, it was interesting. As much as she had a lot of attention on singing, you know, the theme song, DNA, she slipped in a little Korean for good measure. That got people really excited. But the thing that trended was not her voice, excellent, was not her singing, awesome, was not her outfit, which was also amazing, very Korean. Footwear, sneakers.
I didn't know that.
Sneakers. So people at first, it was just, you know, buzzing online, like, why is she wearing sneakers? And of course, everyone to know what sneakers was she's wearing, because, you know, she had this glamorous red carpet-esque outfit, and then yet underneath she had a pair of white kicks. From what I could tell from afar, they look like white high tops, but I couldn't figure out the brand. But people at first are wondering, like, what's going on? Is this like a fashion police violation? What's going on? And then people realized why she did it. And she got a whole lot of props. She did it out of respect for the playing field. Because if you walk onto the playing field with high heels, you're going to poke holes into the field and possibly maybe injure
some of the
soccer players, football players. So she ended up scoring a lot of points. Now, unfortunately, that could not be said for Katy Perry in Los Angeles, because she decided she was going to rock heels. She looked good. She looked great. But then people started to point out, wait a minute, she's messing up the field. So it ended up becoming a hot topic online about footwear. And EJ, she scored. She hit it out of the park with her very tasteful, very smart, and very respectful choice of footwear. Go figure.
Well, kudos to her. What can we expect next?
This is the worst kept secret. So we had an amazing opening ceremony with you know, Lisa expected, EJ unexpected. But I think the next big act that we all know is coming is BTS. Mm. And I think this actually sets us up for the next story. But BTS will be part of the closing ceremonies with other luminaries such as Madonna and a few others. And so we'll wait and see. But BTS is on a roll. They're on the road. And while the games were opening, they came out to Busan to celebrate their 13th anniversary. And I am going to drop the mic and let you sort of run with it for a bit and then kick it back to me. So what do we got, Andrew?
Well, they were in Busan, as you mentioned, this past weekend. A lot of craziness and the expected chaos from their presence in that seaside town. And they're on their world tour, which is sold out, by the way, despite being veterans to playing to these packed house stadiums. A lot of mishaps popping up here and there. Bernie, what went wrong and how could have this been avoided?
So this is a bit of a mystery because, let's face it, BTS has done a lot of concerts, a lot of tours, a lot of stadiums, a lot of arenas, and they've done it a lot of times in Busan. Mm. But in this particular case, for some whatever reason, Busan was not prepared. They knew a lot of people were coming. They kind of prepared for a lot of people coming. But there's certain things that people are asking questions about that still aren't enough answers, but just a lot of apologies. So number one, this one I actually didn't understand why people got upset, but then I had to read up and find out why. It was BTS took the stage an hour late. Mm. Now, in Korea, that's considered late.
Right.
In the U.S. and other markets, that's considered fashionably late, or worse, it's on time. Mm. I've been to shows where sometimes they don't step on for an hour, hour and a half. For the record, Kanye West, when he played Bonnaroo years ago in Tennessee, he was supposed to take the stage at 11. He didn't start singing until 5 in the morning.
What?
So 1 hour late is not bad. And, you know, look, good-looking guys, dressed well. I would have given him the fashionably late card. However, one of the things I didn't think about that I became aware of and informed of, and then I understood where the outrage came from, was a lot of people came to the stadium vis-a-vis through subway, mass transit. And because of the late start, many of them struggled with going home after the show because there was this fear, which I think played out, that a lot of people were not able to go home on mass transit because the show ended up finishing an hour later than expected. So caused a bit of havoc with traffic, but that was not the only problem. Mm. Look, everybody knows that BTS is fantastic with their fans, hence the word fantastic. Ugh, I had to say that. But one of the things they did was they had a goodie bag, a swag bag of a lot of just stuff, cool stuff, collector stuff, the stuff the fans love. Problem is they ran out. You would think they would have done the math properly, like you have this many tickets sold and you have this many bags. And for some reason, there was a mismatch. And to make things worse, people got confused as to which line they needed to wait in, whether it was the merch line to pay for stuff or the swag line to pick up stuff for free. So there was this mix up and confusion, which some people attributed to the delay. Mm. But what upset fans was not just missing out on the goodie bag, but many of them quickly turned around and flipped it online. And what was given away for free was then being resold online for hundreds of dollars.
Profiteering.
And that upset fans. What should have been free all of a sudden became a secondary market at insane prices. And these various complaints were very loud. And the band and the label, you know, they stepped forward quickly to apologize. Mm. And look, it's nice that they apologize, but I don't know if they were the ones that needed to apologize. People are wondering, who were the other BTS behind the scenes that made this, frankly, a hot mess? Mm. So a lot of lessons to be learned, but a lot of people are not happy. And I think that, to me, it was a mystery as to how and why this kind of sort of happened. But look, unfortunately, it is a testament to their wild popularity that some things just kind of got out of their control. But look, they put on a great show and there were a lot of highlights. But it's unfortunate that the rest of the world tour so far has gone smoothly. And the fact that there were a few hiccups and mishaps in the home turf, the backyard, Busan, is, I think, safe to say, a little disappointing. But as they say, the show must go on.
understandable frustrations there among some of the fans. There is at least one more boy band member, or should I say man band member, taking into account this person's age. We're going to be talking about superstar G-Dragon, whose links to this World Cup we talked about last week. In addition to his national team capsule collection dropping online worldwide earlier today, G-Dragon and his bandmates at Big Bang also announced the start of their highly anticipated 20th anniversary world tour dates, and more importantly, ticket sales for their first batch of shows here in South Korea. Bernie, what do you got?
Well, look, I love the fact that you use the word man band. I think it's kind of accurate, but I think the safer word is super band at the moment, because as we all know, Big Bang as a group, phenomenal, but as solo efforts, each and every one of them are superstars in their own right. For full disclosure, for me today, absolute total fail, because G-Dragon's second batch for his capsule collection went on sale at 10 a.m. online.
Here.
I clicked at 10 a.m. I got in. I got on. I was trying to pay. I thought I got it done. At 10:04, everything sold out. Boom, done. Such
like
a disappointment.
10:04 as in minutes or seconds?
In minutes.
Okay.
I mean, I was, you know, I was typing as fast as I could. And by the time I said click, pay, boom, sold out. But regardless, by the way, the collection that he dropped is probably one of the hottest among all the World Cup countries right now. So it doesn't surprise me it sold out so quickly. I'm going to have to wait another 4 years. But nonetheless, as bad as that news was for me personally, on a bigger, better note, is for fans of G-Dragon and for Taesang and also for Taeyang. This was a great day, a big day, because not only was the world tour announced, we all know it's coming, but more importantly, the dates of when the shows are going to be in Seoul, actually technically Goyang, but more importantly, when the tickets are going to go on sale. Now we know. The tickets are officially going to go on sale, and everybody, mark your calendars, break some pencils, grab your pens. 7 p.m. Korean Standard Time on June 25th, which is, by the way, a Thursday. And tickets will go on sale for not one, not two, but three shows, which I think we can safely say will be sold out. It will be on August 21st, August 22nd, and August 23rd, a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, a very long weekend. And so a lot of people are excited for the kickoff of this world tour. And we are now starting to find out more dates of this particular world tour. We know that it will now be 31 performances spanning 18 cities to celebrate their 20th anniversary. But what we know right now is the world tour is going to kick off in Korea end of August. And the rest of the world tour is going to be announced very soon. But already the hype and excitement on the pre-sales, absolutely through the roof.
Is the fourth member joining them?
Oh, that is the mystery question. Personally, I'd love to see it. It would be awesome. But who knows? But for now, what we do know is T.O.P., is definitely having a moment, maybe even a little bit of momentum with his recent latest solo effort. But if we look for kind of hints and signs here and there, especially on social media, there's still a whole lot of love between all the members. So fingers crossed, who knows? We'll see. So yeah, we will save that conversation for end of August.
And this is where we will wrap up our show for today. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Cone, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.